Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Israel is providing weapons to Palestinian militiamen in Gaza who have a pretty shady reputation.
Stealing, drug dealing, smuggling, and of general thuggery.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. More about why the Israelis are arming groups in Gaza. Also today, how the U.S. is helping the island of Taiwan prepare for a possible invasion by China's military.
We should make Taiwan a porcupine.
Too painful to attack.
What's happening to the remittance money being sent from here in the U.S. to Mexico? Preparing for the brutal heat at this year's Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia? And how cutting off their highly prized horns might actually save African rhinos?
The end goal should be rhinos surviving and thriving with their horns.
All that ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for joining us today. We begin in the Middle East, where Israel has acknowledged that it's providing weapons to Palestinian militias in the Gaza Strip.
Earlier this week, Avigdor Lieberman, a party leader in Israel's Knesset, went on Israeli television and said this. Israel is arming criminal gangs in Gaza, Lieberman claimed, and those weapons might one day be pointed at Israelis. News outlets rushed to verify the allegation, but then on Thursday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed it. In a video on social media, Netanyahu said Israel was indeed supporting groups in Gaza that oppose Hamas. What's wrong with that? He asked. Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
The Abu Shabab group led by Yasser Abu Shabab, a leader of a prominent family within the Hamasha tribe of Bedouins in southern Gaza. That's one group. But then there are other Bedouin and semi-Bedouin groups of armed gangs, especially in Gaza's south, that have been increasingly opposed to Hamas rule in Gaza and that have been armed by Israel increasingly over recent months. And to a great extent, the tension comes over control over the aid. There is very little food in Gaza. There is very little material goods in Gaza. So whatever comes in is fought over between Hamas and these armed gangs.
Now, what sort of reputation do these groups have?
Pretty bad. The reputation is of stealing, of drug dealing, of smuggling, and of general thuggery. On the other hand, they have taken the opportunity presented by the current climate of growing instability and unrule to gain control of aid and provide it to people. And that's part of the deal with Israel, I think, is that they should present themselves as a viable alternative to Hamas for the distribution of aid.
Are these groups actually helping to get aid to the Palestinians who need it? Or are they also involved in stealing aid?
Well, both. Exactly both. Getting aid from the Israelis to distribute is stealing aid, right? Like others, including Hamas and others who do the same thing, and they steal a lot of it, and then distributing aid that is both secured from the Israelis or stolen, and then either sold on the black market or distributed for, you know, kind of goodwill, you know, like kind of El Chapo building schools or John Gotti distributing Easter hams, or whatever. Criminals do this stuff all the time. And so they've been doing that as well. And that's helped the Israelis say, now that it's become public that they've been arming these people, it's an alternative to Hamas in all kinds of ways, including in terms of getting food to people.
I mean, as you say, Netanyahu wants them as a counter to Hamas. But does that mean these groups are actually fighting Hamas with the weapons provided them by Israel?
At times, yes. This guy, Abu Shabab, he was imprisoned by Hamas for drug smuggling and criminal accusations when the war with Israel began. And when Israel bombed the Hamas security headquarters in which he was being detained, he escaped. He's on very bad terms with Hamas. And yeah, they've been fighting Hamas without a doubt. And that's why the Israelis have been arming them. Apparently, this is part of Israel's strategy to not just create alternatives to Hamas rule, but to set Hamas against these armed groups and set these armed groups also against each other, and to introduce as many unstable elements as possible to create some kind of, like, I don't know, Somalia-like conditions as a prelude to some next phase we don't know what exactly will be.
Are these groups also controlling territory and therefore making it that area friendlier to Israeli troops on the ground?
Yes. Yes, they are. Yeah, they do control parts of extreme southern Gaza. They operate right now. Abu Shabab's group, for example, is mainly operating in the Rafah area.
Avigdor Lieberman is the Israeli politician who first made this claim. He said these groups have links to ISIS. How credible is that assertion?
It's credible. I mean, look, at the fighter level, there are clearly people in this gang and in other gangs that Israel has armed, right? Because there are others. It's not just this one group who have, when they've become political, gone the Salafist jihadist route and been associated with ISIS and ISIS-like extremist factions. On the other hand, Abu Shabab himself has been trying to present himself as linked to the Palestinian Authority.
Hussein, what about all this are you most eager to know more about? I mean, what are you looking for in coming weeks?
Well, I mean, I'd like to know what Israel's strategy is. I mean, it's the same question we've been asking for the last year and a half. What do the Israelis want here? What's their long-term strategy? I don't know. It would be interesting to know about the other armed factions in Gaza that are emerging in the chaos and is really setting up a condition, as I said, of Somalia on the Mediterranean here. Very disturbing.
Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
The final rounds of major tennis tournaments are usually filled with top-ranked players who become well-known names like Rafael Nadal or Serena Williams. To some extent, that's true at this year's French Open, which is happening now in Paris. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, there's been one notable exception.
Louise Boisson had no business making Jessica Pegula nervous in the fourth round of this year's French Open. Barely any fans even showed up to the match. The stands looked sparse. But that's the thing about sports. Anything can happen. Boisson is a French tennis player ranked 361st in the world who made it into the tournament as a wild card. She came from behind to beat Pegula, who's ranked third in the world. Many people chalked it up to being a fluke. Then she did it again. Boisson made quick work of her opponent in the quarterfinals, winning in straight sets. At 22 years old, Boisson, who had ACL surgery just last year, could have been satisfied with getting further than anyone expected. But she said this isn't a miracle. It's the result of hard work.
I think every kid who plays tennis have the dream to win a slam. More for French player to win Roland Garros, for sure. I will go for the dream because my dream is to win it, not to be in the semifinal. So I will try to do my best for it.
Boisson did her best in yesterday's semifinals, but this time it wasn't her day. She lost to world number two, Coco Gauff. Boisson isn't walking away empty-handed, though. She's expected to jump nearly 300 spots in the world rankings next week and got a check for almost $800,000, more than five times what she's earned in her entire professional career. Gauff, meanwhile, is heading to the finals. She'll face Arina Sabalenka from Belarus.
I'm just thrilled with the performance today, with this win.
Sabalenka is ranked number one in the world and has won three Grand Slam tournaments, so it may seem like advancing out of the semifinals is a bit expected. But she had to beat Iga Świątek, the queen of the clay, who has won the French Open for the past 3 years, to do it.
Almost like the whole life I've been told that clay court is not my thing, and then I didn't have any confidence in the past, I don't know how many years, we've been able to develop my game so much, so I feel that if I'll be able to get this trophy, it's just going to mean the world for us.
The women's singles final is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 Eastern. The men's final will round out the tournament on Sunday. Earlier today, Spain's Carlos Alcaraz took on Italy's Lorenzo Musetti for a spot.
Oh, Musetti knocking off bottle tops with that backhand.
Musetti took the first set, Alcaraz the second and third. Then in the fourth, the match ended abruptly when Musetti dropped out due to injury.
He's going to retire. That's
and
it.
That is it. It's the saddest, most frustrating end for Lorenzo Musetti.
Reigning French Open champion Alcaraz will now try to defend his title on Sunday. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam is dedicated to Dutch art and history. It actually functions as the National Museum of the Netherlands. A new exhibit there is focused on 19th century sexuality and prostitution. And as the world's Aaron Schachter reports, it has one particular display that's getting lots of attention.
I want to start off with a warning. This may get a little juvenile. The point of the Rijksmuseum exhibit is, as they say, to highlight a subject underrepresented in their collection, which, says Phil Verda, is a real shame, since erotic art can teach us a lot about the society in which it was made.
I might want to find out more about how women were represented in erotic art, and I might want to find out more about society and religious repression. I might be interested in healthcare. All kinds of different aspects come out of these so-called erotic works.
Verda spends his days looking at what he jokingly calls dirty pictures. He runs the Archives of Sexuality and Gender, 16th to 20th century, for Gale. That's a company that digitizes art and academic materials.
You're not just seeing a naked form. Sometimes you're seeing court fashions. You're seeing some aspect of society of the past. A lot of it was educational, or it was a diatribe against the government. It was something against the church.
And that brings us to what's really special about the Rijksmuseum's new exhibit. At the center of the display is a rare condom dating from 1830, made from a sheep's appendix. And it features an erotic etching depicting a nun and three clergymen, each with their robes pulled aside to reveal their...
What is it, son? I don't know, sir. But it looks like a giant...
Yeah.
And in fact, the nun seems to be choosing between the displays before her. There is an inscription on the condom, "Voilà mon choix," meaning "this is my choice." Art historians believe this was a parody of both celibacy and the judgment of Paris from Greek mythology. Marjorie Rawl is with the fine art gallery M.S. Rau, which held an exhibit and sale of erotic art a few years ago. She says the fact that this is from the 19th century, Victorian era, is kind of surprising.
It's where all of our kind of shyness or properness and kind of prudishness really comes from, that era where everything had to be moral, and being specifically from that era is really interesting.
The condom was likely handed out at a brothel as a souvenir. Now, both Verda and Rawl point out that there's a difference between erotic art and pornography. One has layers of story you can tease apart. The other is strictly goal-oriented. Rawl points out that erotic, like obscene, is in the eye of the beholder. Same with nakedness versus nudity. Two of Monet's most famous paintings, Olympia and Luncheon on the Grass, were once considered lewd because of the way they portrayed naked women.
They were brash. They were making eye contact with the viewer. They were normal women. They weren't goddesses. And he's showing naked women instead of proper ways of displaying the female nude. And it was seen as way too erotic for acceptable society.
The exhibit in Amsterdam runs until November. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
You're with The World.
Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000, and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Rhinos have long been targeted by poachers who often kill the animals just to harvest their horns. The illegal trade in rhino horns has contributed to a significant decline in the African rhino population. But conservationists say one anti-poaching approach works better than others, removing rhino horns before someone else, poachers, do. That's the takeaway from the research published in the journal Science this week. Tim Kuiper is a senior lecturer in biodiversity and statistics at Nelson Mandela University in South Africa.
In the particular region that we've been studying, the rhino population in the last 10 to 15 years has gone from over 10,000 individuals to less than 3,000. So we're talking about a 70 to 80% decline in rhino populations due to poaching. And we've seen similar declines a few decades back. There's been surges of poaching that have occurred across Africa at different times.
So what is behind this current surge? Are rhino horns more valuable than they have been in the past?
There's a lot of debate around what actually caused the current surge. It kind of began around 2007, 2008, and it peaked in 2011, and thankfully since then going down slightly. But part of that might just be that there's less rhinos to poach. But what's driving it is demand in consumer nations. This is not my area of expertise, the demand side, but I understand that it's primarily for medicinal use, but also as a status symbol to demonstrate wealth. That's a rare product, even used for things like curing hangovers, I've read in some scientific research from Vietnam. So yeah, a wide array of uses, but I think primarily in traditional Chinese medicine.
So your and your collaborators' analysis has found that dehorning is the most effective anti-poaching approach that is being taken in the region that you study. How does dehorning work?
Yes, that's right. It came out as very effective in reducing poaching. How it works is a very sophisticated team that includes an experienced veterinarian will identify a rhino that still has its horn, either find it via helicopter or by vehicle. And when the individual is identified, it is moved to a safe area where the team can access it, and it's immobilized via a dart gun. Once it's immobilized, the team moves in, checks the vital signs of the rhino, makes sure everything is safe, and they use a chainsaw, typically, to remove the horn. Not right the way down to the very base, because there's some nervous tissue there, but it's the same material as our fingernails or hair, so they cut off the majority of the horn. These days, it's become a well-oiled machine, and it can be done in 10 to 15 minutes. Then the rhino is given an antidote.
So this doesn't hurt the animals?
No, it would be similar to cutting off fingernails, for example. That's not to say it's not a stressful thing for the rhinos. I'm certain it's a stressful event to be immobilized and to have a helicopter hovering over you. So I think it does cause the animal some stress, but no injury, very rarely.
And they don't need the horns later for some purpose? I mean, it doesn't harm them later on after they're cut off?
It's a good question. So rhinos do use their horns. And one thing we want to make clear with the study is that we're hoping this is a short-term fix that buys us time to address the more ultimate drivers of poaching. The end goal should be rhinos surviving and thriving with their horns. But to answer your question, they do use their horns in territorial disputes. For example, and males use them when they fight. And some evidence that mothers might use them to move calves and so forth. Again, not my area of expertise. There has been a lot of research done into how this dehorning affects rhinos' behavior. And without going into too much detail, no major red flags have been raised in terms of fundamentally altering the rhino's survival or sociality or reproduction. There is some evidence, which is quite interesting, that rhinos contract their home ranges. So they range over a smaller area after they've been dehorned. And we think this is partly because they are more afraid of interacting socially with other rhinos in the absence of a horn.
Interesting. What is done with the horn after it's cut off?
The horns are stored in a safe facility in an undisclosed location just because there's a risk that the horn will be stolen once it's been removed. The horns cannot be sold or traded in any way because currently the international trade in rhino horn is illegal. So for now, they're kept in stockpiles in secure locations.
You mentioned that dehorning rhinos should be seen as a short-term anti-poaching solution. What is the longer-term solution here?
This gets into some difficult territory because what's required is quite a lot of work. And to explain this, we can look at the effect that whilst dogs and cameras and helicopters, sniffer dogs, that sort of thing, achieved a large amount of poacher arrests, according to our data, those arrests did not always translate into less poaching.
Yeah, I was struck by the stat that you have that all these interventions that cost $74 million over several years didn't significantly reduce poaching at all.
Yes. We're careful to say that they did achieve what they were designed to achieve, which was to detect and arrest poachers. So they were successful on that count. So why then did detecting and arresting a large amount of poachers not reduce poaching? So that was a really interesting question for us. And one of the reasons we think is these criminal syndicates that drive poaching thrive in an environment where there's impoverishment, where the people alongside these nature reserves do not have opportunities, high levels of unemployment. They then can more easily recruit young men, for example, to participate in rhino poaching in order to get a quick source of income. I don't think someone wakes up in the morning and thinks, I'm poor and unemployed, I'm going to kill a rhino. I don't think anyone would make that choice, or very few people would make such a choice, unless they didn't have any alternatives. So I think one of the long-term solutions is to address human well-being, ensure that the people in these areas have better lives, because there's high degrees of unemployment and poverty in the area surrounding the reserves we study. Yeah, and also, I think traditionally, local people living next to the reserves have often been excluded from conservation. They've kind of been pushed aside. They can't even afford to visit the park, for example, and they don't feel like they have a stake or a voice in conservation, and that might also play into decisions when the syndicate comes along and offers an opportunity for quick money through poaching.
So like so much else, it's a difficult economic problem to solve here, not one simple conservation strategy.
Yeah, it's beyond conservation, you're right.
You found that dehorning was the most effective anti-poaching strategy. Just how effective was it?
So what we found in the places where it was implemented, it resulted in an 80% reduction in poaching. So whatever the poaching rate was before, it declined by 80%. That's the average effect across the different reserves that did apply it. So yeah, we're talking pretty large numbers of rhinos saved that would have been poached without dehorning.
Tom Kuiper is a senior lecturer in biodiversity and statistics at Nelson Mandela University in South Africa. More global stories are coming your way. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Rhinos have long been targeted by poachers who often kill the animals just to harvest their horns. The illegal trade in rhino horns has contributed to a significant decline in the African rhino population. But conservationists say one anti-poaching approach works better than others, removing rhino horns before someone else, poachers, do. That's the takeaway from the research published in the journal Science this week. Tim Kuiper is a senior lecturer in biodiversity and statistics at Nelson Mandela University in South Africa.
In the particular region that we've been studying, the rhino population in the last 10 to 15 years has gone from over 10,000 individuals to less than 3,000. So we're talking about a 70 to 80% decline in rhino populations due to poaching. And we've seen similar declines a few decades back. There's been surges of poaching that have occurred across Africa at different times.
So what is behind this current surge? Are rhino horns more valuable than they have been in the past?
There's a lot of debate around what actually caused the current surge. It kind of began around 2007, 2008, and it peaked in 2011, and thankfully since then going down slightly. But part of that might just be that there's less rhinos to poach. But what's driving it is demand in consumer nations. This is not my area of expertise, the demand side, but I understand that it's primarily for medicinal use, but also as a status symbol to demonstrate wealth. That's a rare product, even used for things like curing hangovers, I've read in some scientific research from Vietnam. So yeah, a wide array of uses, but I think primarily in traditional Chinese medicine.
So your and your collaborators' analysis has found that dehorning is the most effective anti-poaching approach that is being taken in the region that you study. How does dehorning work?
Yes, that's right. It came out as very effective in reducing poaching. How it works is a very sophisticated team that includes an experienced veterinarian will identify a rhino that still has its horn, either find it via helicopter or by vehicle. And when the individual is identified, it is moved to a safe area where the team can access it, and it's immobilized via a dart gun. Once it's immobilized, the team moves in, checks the vital signs of the rhino, makes sure everything is safe, and they use a chainsaw, typically, to remove the horn. Not right the way down to the very base, because there's some nervous tissue there, but it's the same material as our fingernails or hair, so they cut off the majority of the horn. These days, it's become a well-oiled machine, and it can be done in 10 to 15 minutes. Then the rhino is given an antidote.
So this doesn't hurt the animals?
No. It would be similar to cutting our fingernails, for example. That's not to say it's not a stressful thing for rhinos. I'm certain it's a stressful event to be immobilized and to have a helicopter hovering over you. So I think it does cause the animal some stress, but no injury, very rarely.
And they don't need the horns later for some purpose? I mean, it doesn't harm them later on after they're cut off?
It's a good question. So rhinos do use their horns. And one thing we want to make clear with the study is that we're hoping this is a short-term fix that buys us time to address the more ultimate drivers of poaching. The end goal should be rhinos surviving and thriving with their horns. But to answer your question, they do use their horns in territorial disputes, for example, and males use them when they fight. And some evidence that mothers might use them to move calves and so forth. Again, not my area of expertise. There has been a lot of research done into how this dehorning affects rhinos' behavior. And without going into too much detail, no major red flags have been raised in terms of fundamentally altering the rhino's survival or sociality or reproduction. There is some evidence, which is quite interesting, that rhinos contract their home ranges. So they range over a smaller area after they've been dehorned. And we think this is partly because they are more afraid of interacting socially with other rhinos in the absence of a horn.
Interesting. What is done with the horn after it's cut off?
The horns are stored in a safe facility in an undisclosed location just because there's a risk that the horn will be stolen once it's been removed. The horns cannot be sold or traded in any way because currently the international trade in rhino horn is illegal. So for now, they're kept in stockpiles in secure locations.
You mentioned that dehorning rhinos should be seen as a short-term anti-poaching solution. What is the longer-term solution here?
This gets into some difficult territory because what's required is quite a lot of work. And to explain this, we can look at the effect that whilst dogs and cameras and helicopters, sniffer dogs, that sort of thing, achieved a large amount of poacher arrests according to our data, those arrests did not always translate into less poaching.
Yeah, I was struck by the stat that you have that all these interventions that cost $74 million over several years didn't significantly reduce poaching at all.
Yes, we're careful to say that they did achieve what they were designed to achieve, which was to detect and arrest poachers. So they were successful on that count. So why then did detecting and arresting a large amount of poachers not reduce poaching? So that was a really interesting question for us. And one of the reasons we think is these criminal syndicates that drive poaching thrive in an environment where there's impoverishment, where the people alongside these nature reserves do not have opportunities, high levels of unemployment. They then can more easily recruit young men, for example, to participate in rhino poaching in order to get a quick source of income. I don't think someone wakes up in the morning and thinks, I'm poor and unemployed, I'm going to kill a rhino. I don't think anyone would make that choice, or very few people would make such a choice, unless they didn't have any alternatives. So I think one of the long-term solutions is to address human well-being, ensure that the people in these areas have better lives, because there's high degrees of unemployment and poverty in the area surrounding the reserves we study. Yeah, and also, I think traditionally, local people living next to the reserves have often been excluded from conservation. They've kind of been pushed aside. They can't even afford to visit the park, for example, and they don't feel like they have a stake or a voice in conservation, and that might also play into decisions when the syndicate comes along and offers an opportunity for quick money through poaching.
So like so much else, it's a difficult economic problem to solve here, not one simple conservation strategy.
Yeah, it's beyond conservation, you're right.
You found that dehorning was the most effective anti-poaching strategy. Just how effective was it?
So what we found in the places where it was implemented, it resulted in an 80% reduction in poaching. So whatever the poaching rate was before, it declined by 80%. That's the average effect across the different reserves that did apply it. So yeah, we're talking pretty large numbers of rhinos saved that would have been poached without dehorning.
Tom Kuiper is a senior lecturer in biodiversity and statistics at Nelson Mandela University in South Africa. More global stories are coming your way. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Millions of families in Mexico rely on money sent by their loved ones here in the United States to cover their basic needs. Mexico is one of the largest recipients of what's called remittances in the world. But in April, remittances from the U.S. to Mexico fell by more than 12%. It was the sharpest decline in more than a decade. And now a proposed tax in Washington could make sending money abroad even more difficult. The World's Tibi Zaizea reports from Mexico City.
In a poor and densely populated suburb of Mexico City, Luz María Taboya has long depended on the money her two sons sent from the United States. For years, they would send her about $200 a month. It wasn't a fortune, but it helped cover part of her rent. Earlier this year, her sons started to send less money. And in the past 2 months, they weren't able to send anything. The situation is complicated in the U.S. right now, Taboya says. Her two sons are undocumented, and they told her they're saving money just in case they get deported. Plus, there's been a few days where they didn't show up for work for fear of immigration raids.
Hasta la fecha todavía ahorita Me voy con una señora que está enfermita, le lavo sus trastes, me da 40 pesos.
Now, Taboya, who's 70 years old, is cleaning people's houses and taking care of a sick neighbor to make ends meet. Her story is not unique. Remittances sent to families in Mexico are now at the lowest level in 13 years, according to central bank data published this week. Helen Dempster with the Center for Global Development says, some seasonal drop in remittances is normal, but this year's decline is more concerning.
A 12% drop will definitely lead to greater levels of financial stress among friends and family back home.
She says private remittances often reach communities more directly and efficiently than government assistance. In Mexico, remittances account for nearly 5% of Mexico's economy, and in some rural states, that figure can triple. One factor contributing to the drop, according to Dempster, is that some sectors of the U.S. economy are slowing down.
For example, construction industry job openings slowed to their lowest rate on record. And we know that roughly 30% of the construction industry is made up of immigrants, with a high proportion of those being undocumented. Therefore, we could expect this will have an impact on employment options for undocumented workers and therefore remittance flows.
While the cost of living in the U.S. has been rising, many wages are not keeping up. Another reason behind the drop of remittances could be the hostile environment immigrants in the U.S. are facing right now.
Migrants may avoid sending money home for fear of losing their jobs and being deported.
On top of these challenges is a proposed 3.5% tax on remittances sent by non-U.S. citizens. It's included in the One Big Beautiful Bill recently passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. President Trump and other proponents of the tax say it would generate funds to enhance border security and immigration enforcement. But opponents say it will be a burden for many immigrants trying to help their loved ones abroad. Manuel Orozco is the director of the Migration and Remittances Program at the Inter-American Dialogue.
A 3.5% tax is very high. It's pretty close to a sales tax on an income that already you have paid taxes.
This type of tax has no precedent in the U.S., but sending money abroad usually means paying commissions and fees. The global average cost of sending $200 abroad is about $13, according to the International Organization for Migration. Orozco worries this tax could drive remittances underground. People might start mailing cash or using intermediaries.
And by doing that, they are going to increase the chances of having been prey to illicit transactions.
A sharp decline in remittances could hurt entire economies that are extremely dependent on them, like El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, or Haiti, where remittances account for about 20% of the GDP or more. For The World, I'm Tibi Zaizea, Mexico City.
There's a truce in place between the U.S. and the Houthis in Yemen, but that ceasefire stopped a military conflict in the Red Sea that was much more intense than previously known. The Houthis presented a real threat to U.S. warships. They used a range of different weapons, some of which hadn't been used before, like anti-ship missiles. Stephen Kalin wrote about all of this in detail for The Wall Street Journal. To start, I asked him about one specific attack by the Houthis on the USS Stockdale.
This is something that happened late last year in the Red Sea. The Stockdale is a destroyer, and it was sailing through one of the narrowest points. Whenever the American ships were passing through this area, the Houthis were pretty much guaranteed to fire on them. The crew had prepared for this passage, knowing from experience that it was going to be dangerous. So they switched off their lights and they started moving in a zigzag to make it more difficult for the Houthis. There was an officer on board that night who later spoke about it and described how it sort of just started off as one missile, then a drone, then a few more missiles, and it really just kept on going for hours and hours. And they did manage to intercept all of these projectiles that were shot towards them. Some of them fell short, but the crew of the Stockdale shot down a lot of incoming attacks that night.
And so why is this indicative of what was happening in the Red Sea for months on end? Tell me what the patterns were.
The goal of the Navy was to stop missiles and drones that were being launched from Yemen from hitting ships going through the Red Sea and also going towards Israel. And an offensive one, their aircraft carriers that were in the Red Sea could deploy fighter jets to go drop bombs onto Houthi positions, either positions where there was an imminent attack, you know, a missile launcher site, for example, or stocks of weapons or fuel or other material that allowed the Houthis to launch these attacks. So in doing that, they were based in the Red Sea mostly. There were also some operations in the Arabian Sea, but the Red Sea is really a little more than 200 miles wide at its widest. And so it's a pretty small area to operate in. It meant that the ships were often within sight of the shore. And it's not just of Yemen, but there's a few other countries. There's the possibility of Houthi spotters looking out for these ships. And this battle went on for so long that actually both sides kind of got used to the way the other ones were operating and had to adapt. And they often only had a couple of minutes to pick up a lot of these attacks. And usually they had to decide on a course of action to intercept them within 15 seconds.
Wow. Such quick reaction times needed.
Yeah.
You know, it's striking. The U.S. has the most powerful military in history. The Houthis are a militant group in one of the poorest countries in the world. How was that group able to wage what you call the fiercest maritime battle since World War II?
Yeah, and that's how the Navy leadership, military leadership of the Pentagon has been describing this this battle, actually. You know, the Houthis have been repeatedly underestimated by their enemies, including Saudi Arabia, which spent 7 years trying to defeat them. The key, really, to all this, so the Houthis get a lot of technology for their weaponry from the Iranians. There's been a history over years of smuggling of these weapons, but the cost of making those weapons is relatively small compared to the cost of the U.S. systems, most of the systems that are being used to intercept them. The U.S. military is working on new innovative techniques to bring down that cost.
Stephen, I'm wondering if you have figures on that. So how much is, you know, a drone that the Houthis would send over a U.S. ship, and how much does it cost for an anti-aircraft missile or whatever it is that they're using to shoot it out of the air?
Some of these drones and missiles are in the thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, and some of the systems that are being used to intercept them can cost $1 million. The amount of munitions that were expended, both in shooting into Yemen to hit those Houthi sites, but also intercepting what they were shooting at the U.S., that was at least $1.5 billion over the past year and a half. So this is the challenge. I mean, it's just long-term, it's not cost-effective for the U.S. to keep fighting cheap drones and missiles. We're in a moment of really extraordinary technological development in this area. And so as quickly as one side comes up with a new, cheaper technique to take down drones and missiles, the other side comes up with an innovation to get around that. So it's really sort of a continuous cycle.
Did U.S. warships run low on the missiles they needed?
We didn't find that there was really an acute shortage, but getting to a place where they could reload and sort of take the old ones off and put the new ones on was challenging, because at the start they didn't have any ports in the Red Sea. There are no U.S. military bases there. They asked a friendly country that eventually agreed to let them base there. They struggled a bit in the beginning. There are concerns more broadly that expending this amount of munitions could eventually degrade the stockpiles that the U.S. has after giving a lot to Ukraine, selling a lot to Ukraine for its war, and wanting to obviously keep a stockpile in the case of a conflict in Asia, for example.
So, Stephen, no U.S. ships were ultimately struck by Houthis. There is a ceasefire now. Did the U.S. campaign ultimately succeed in its objectives?
The Trump administration says that, they claim success with this truce, saying that they've restored freedom of navigation. The reality is a little bit more complex. The terms of the agreement were that the U.S. would stop bombing the Houthis and the Houthis would stop attacking U.S. ships. There are many other ships from many other nations that pass through the Red Sea. Those haven't been attacked in the past month since the ceasefire has been on. But actually, most of the ships that had stopped going through the Red Sea haven't gone back because they're quite nervous about whether this will hold. And ultimately, the Houthis are still firing missiles pretty regularly at Israel, which was not necessarily a stated goal of the Trump administration's campaign, but the Biden administration, which started this back in late 2023, one of their intentions was to get the Houthis to stop hitting Israel, and that really hasn't come to fruition.
Stephen Kalin is a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal.
Many U.S. officials believe China plans to be ready to invade Taiwan by the year 2027. That's prompted a new push in Congress to send additional American weaponry to the island as fast as possible, so Taiwan will be better prepared to fend off any possible invasion. But some also wonder, is America sending the right weapons to Taiwan? The World's Patrick Wynn reports.
Republicans and Democrats in Congress don't agree on much, but they do broadly believe in this.
We should make Taiwan a porcupine.
So says U.S. Senator Roger Wicker in a recent hearing. Porcupines are small, but even a ferocious beast knows not to step on them. America wants Taiwan to be so prickly, so loaded down with American weapons, that China thinks twice about taking over the democratic island about 100 miles off its coast. To accomplish that, the U.S. wants more weapons on Taiwan quickly. Here's Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in a speech days ago.
There's no reason to sugarcoat it. The threat China poses is real, and it could be imminent. We hope not, but it certainly could be.
But you wouldn't guess that from how painfully slowly the U.S. sends weapons to Taiwan. High-tech rocket launchers ordered by Taiwan 5 years ago just arrived this spring. F-16 fighter jets ordered 6 years ago. Some delivered recently, but most still undelivered. A lag of 4 to 8 years is pretty typical.
A lot of these weapon systems that Taiwan is buying are hugely complex.
Drew Thompson is with Nanyang Technical University in Singapore. For many years, he was the U.S. Defense Department's liaison to Taiwan's military.
So this is not like buying a car at a dealership and driving it off the lot and knowing how to operate it.
Like new model F-16s. Thompson says they're packed with customized software and targeting systems specialized for Taiwan. These take time to design and build, and the U.S. military-industrial complex is already strained, supplying Saudi Arabia, Ukraine, Japan, Australia, and many more, not to mention America itself.
This is true for every U.S. defense acquisition, too. How many of them are run on time and under budget?
Still, Congress is impatient. There are two bills in Congress seeking to speed up weapons going to Taiwan. One called the Taiwan Plus Act. The other is the Porcupine Act. Thompson isn't sure they'll work.
I don't think Congress passing legislation necessarily speeds that up. I mean, keep in mind, U.S. arms exports are governed by laws that Congress wrote, and they are as thick as an old-fashioned phone book.
Some think the weapons the U.S. keeps selling Taiwan are old-fashioned, too. War game simulations suggest Taiwan wouldn't last long going jet for jet, sub for sub, tank for tank, not against China's huge military. The idea behind going porcupine mode is building a grittier, more slippery force. Mobile missile launchers hidden on every corner of the island. Swarms of exploding drones. The type of weapons Ukraine has used to hold off Russia. Here's Shen Ming-shu, an ex-army colonel in Taiwan.
Taiwan still need to build a strong counterforce to make China feel that is not the best time to attack Taiwan today.
Shin is now a military strategist with Taiwan's government-backed Institute for National Defense and Security Research. He says to survive, Taiwan probably needs the big-ticket items, jets, submarines, and tanks, to fend off an initial invasion. And then the so-called porcupine weapons, loads of drones and shoulder-fired missiles, to keep resisting once the jets and warships are toast. Shin says Taiwan's generals are still warming up to this idea.
In the official report of Taiwan, porcupine strategy was not mentioned.
Porcupines may not be mentioned in Taiwan's strategic plans, but it's definitely the buzzword in America's Congress. U.S. politicians are pressuring Taiwan to buy more weapons, period. Tanks, drones, missiles, everything. They're not happy Taiwan only spends 2.5% of its GDP on defense. Here's Republican Senator Dan Sullivan in March.
They're playing a dangerous game on their defense budget. If anyone from Taiwan is watching this hearing, they need to realize they're playing a dangerous game.
Shin, the former colonel, says whatever his army orders, whether pricey jets or cheaper drones, the weapons have to come soon, or else they're meaningless. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Now, I want you to picture a perfect beach day. Sunshine, a blanket, plenty of snacks. Feeling relaxed? Well, snap out of it. This situation demands vigilance. Seagulls may be circling, and they'll pluck that treat right out of your hands.
Or from the trash. Seagulls are not picky. They've been spotted eating all kinds of things, including whole rats. We know this because there is an entire database documenting the phenomenon.
It's called Gulls Eating Stuff, and it's a citizen science project to help researchers understand the seagull diet. Here's how it works. You see a gull eating some stuff, you snap a photo, and you send it in, along with answers to a questionnaire.
The first question answered by observers in 298 distinct locations around the world is the obvious one. What was the gull eating? The answers, they are exhaustive.
French fries at Burger King. Donut scraps out of a paper bag. A freshly killed rabbit. A dead pigeon. A living pigeon, though presumably not for long. A banana. Gulls sometimes drink the milk of seals.
That is weird to picture. Alice Risley started the project. She's an ecologist at the University of Salford in the UK. And although the database is entertaining, it is also teaching her team a lot about how gull behavior differs from place to place.
In South America, gulls have been eating the flesh of sleeping whales. A reminder that when a seagull swoops in to nab a sandwich or a bag of chips on the beach, that's a truly predatory skill.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today marks a special celebration for Muslims around the world. Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice, is the second of two main festivals in Islam. It honors the willingness of Abraham to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God. It's a time when Muslims symbolically and often literally sacrifice a sheep.
The festival falls each year during the Hajj, the annual Islamic pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. The 5 to 6 day religious journey draws more than a million people from across the globe. And this year, once again, the extreme heat is a major issue. Dr. Hina Shahid is the chair of the Muslim Doctors Association and joins us from London.
So I went myself in 2019. I actually also went with my parents, who were in their 60s, 70s, and, you know, we didn't have any problems. But one member of our group measured that he'd walked 30,000 steps in, you know, over the course of one day, and there are at least 3 days where you have to do long walks and then, you know, camping. But that, you know, it's kind of like glamping. You're in air-conditioned tents. And, you know, when I went 6 years ago, the temperature was over 50 degrees.
That's 50 degrees Celsius, so we're talking incredibly hot.
Yes, yes.
And you said 30,000 steps. That's like about 10 miles, isn't it? I mean, that's a lot in a single day.
Yes, Yes. Now, not everybody will do those number of steps. So, you know, some people like my parents, for example, they were able to take a bus or a coach or taxi from one place to another place if they were not able to walk. But also what we do say is, you know, take sensible precautions. And the Saudi ministry this year has issued, you know, very strict guidance around that.
Well, I want to get to that, but I want to ask first, what makes the addition of extreme heat so concerning when it comes to this religious event?
It is a physically challenging task. And then on top of that, if you are exposed to high temperatures for a prolonged period of time, then that can cause a whole range of health problems. Obviously, the risk of heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and it does come with health risks.
Now, people have died while on the Hajj because of the heat. Last year was especially bad with a heat wave killing more than 1,000 people. What's happening this year to prevent a similar tragedy?
Yeah, I mean, that was absolutely tragic, you know, and it should not have happened. What the Saudis have said is that, you know, the authorities have really stepped up the safety precautions because of what happened last year. And so some of the things that they've done is, you know, increase the number of shaded spaces, planting more trees. Obviously, that's going to take a bit of time. Install more water coolers, air conditioning available in all the tents. And what they have said is a large proportion of those pilgrims who died, unfortunately, last year were unregistered. So they didn't have access to, you know, some of that, the air conditioning tents or facilities where people were staying. And that obviously puts them at risk. So they have really tried to clamp down on the number of unregistered pilgrims that are you know, entering in the country and wanting to participate in the Hajj, because if they're unregistered, then it's difficult to know, you know, what the living circumstances are, what their risks are as well.
So those kind of additional steps like more UV umbrellas, fans, drinking water, is that enough medically to counter what happens to your body when it's exposed to that level of heat for that long?
Well, the first thing to say is that the other really important piece of guidance is to stay out of the sun between 10 and 4 p.m. That's what the Saudi authorities have said. You know, that's the hottest time of the day. And so the recommendation is to not do those physically demanding rituals that I've mentioned, you know, the ones that involve long walks in those temperatures at that time, at those specific times of day, because we know that your risk of heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and other related risks are higher.
Is it the kind of thing where when you do the Hajj, you can kind of do the walking and do what you have to do at any time of day? Or are there certain periods of the time where you have to be out there?
Well, you have to do it in the, you know, in the daylight hours. And so there is a time, there's a window period, because you're constantly moving. You know, so you can go early in the morning and you can go after, you know, the sun has kind of reached its peak. So, so you know, when we went, we spaced it out over the 3 days that we were doing those particularly demanding rituals.
You've done the Hajj, and as someone who's done it, why is it so important, even with the heat, to complete this pilgrimage? What does it mean?
You know, the Hajj is, you know, it is a hugely spiritual experience. It does challenge you, but, you know, growth comes through challenge, and it changes you. I don't feel like I've come back the same person. It's a real test of patience, of compassion. You're living with lots of different people, you know, camping with different people. You're meeting people from all over the world. You know, you're learning about different cultures as well. So it's just such an incredible experience.
Dr. Hina Shahid is the chair of the Muslim Doctors Association. She spoke to us from London.
Kara Melia's mom always wanted to travel the world, but life just kind of got in the way. So when she died in February of heart disease at just 51 years old, Melia thought, well, maybe better late than never.
It was just kind of like on a whim.
Kara Melia spoke to BBC Manchester.
Me and my best friend were talking for her to see the world. And then I was talking to my cousin about it as well. And they both came up with the idea of, like, put her in a bottle, put her out to sea, see where she ends up.
Melia put her mother's ashes in a glass bottle, tore off a piece of paper, and jotted down a note. "This is my mom," she wrote. "Throw her back in. She's traveling the world. Kara from Oldham." Then Melia said her goodbyes and chucked the bottle into the sea.
12 hours later, the bottle was found by a woman and her son on the very same beach. The woman wrote a Facebook post about it that went viral. It said, "We found this lovely lady earlier today at Butlin's Skegness Beach. She's been thrown back in the sea as requested. Happy travels, Cara's mum."
My best mate ended up ringing me and she went, "Your mum's on Facebook." I was like, "What do you mean?" When I logged on, it was just all over there. I was like, "Someone's found her already." Like, that wasn't my plan.
Melia hoped her mom's ashes would turn up years later somewhere in the Caribbean, or in Spain at the very least. But no, she was doomed to stay in Skegness, a place that's consistently ranked as Britain's worst seaside town in travel polls. Melia said her mom would have found the whole thing seriously amusing.
Oh, she'd be giggling at the fact of how it's even happened.
Now that her ashes are back once again in the sea, Melia hopes this time the journey will last a little longer and take her mother to farther shores.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.